There's a way, a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for another Atomic Show. Yes, they're coming fast and furious these days. It's easier to get hold of people when people still aren't traveling very much, and they will even take time off their busy Saturday mornings to sit down and talk with me. Today, I have the pleasure of having a discussion with an old friend. You all have heard her before many times on the Atomic Show. It's Meredith Angwin, the author of Shorting the Grid, I can't remember the subtitle.
The subtitle is The Hidden Fragility of Our Electric Grid. Hidden is a big word.
Hidden fragility, yes. Because from a public point of view, if we just turn on the light switch, things just seem to work all the time. At least that's what we've been used to for the last 45, 50 years. Maybe even longer than that. But Meredith and I go back a long ways. We first met on a trip to France sponsored by Arriva back when they were trying to encourage bloggers to learn more about their capabilities and their installations. And so we had a wonderful journey and got to know each other. The way that you really get to know people is by spending all day, every day, for a week at a time with them. So, Meredith, I'm happy to have you on the show again, and extremely happy that you have gotten into the very, very final sprint of releasing an important, bigger book than you wanted to release, but it's almost here.
Yes, it is bigger than I wanted it to release. The thing is that when you're learning about the grid, you write something and you check it with somebody who's very knowledgeable and they say, well, most of the time, yes, but you understand that. In other words, the situation is so layered and so complex and that it's almost impossible to write something short about it without just leaving out a lot of stuff. So anyway, the book isn't all that long. I mean, it's 400 pages, but it's not, 900 pages. I mean, I have to look at it that way.
Well, you are writing about the largest machine ever invented, and probably one of the, well, I don't know if I'd say one of those. I'd say it is the most important part of our modern infrastructure. Without electricity, our modern way of life grinds to a halt rather quickly.
If you the book Lights Out by Ted Koppel, he goes through some predictions of what would happen if there was a major power failure in the United States and that it would last for like 6 months or a year. And the predictions are like 80% of the people in the U.S. die. I mean, that's a kind of level of predictions. And I don't mean to be terrifying about it, but yes, it is the one. It is the infrastructure that we all depend on. We really all depend on it just to stay alive. I mean, to have warm houses, to have refrigerated food, to fill our gas tanks with the pump at the gas station, all those things.
To get clean water out of the tap.
Yes.
It's incredible. And, many people have noticed that. And there have been some recent very good work about the importance of electricity. I had Robert Bryce on a few episodes ago and talked about Juice, the movie, and the importance of electricity for human development. But let's go a little bit back to the book. I have to admit to everyone that I have read this book probably almost as often as anybody, except for Meredith and George. But I went back and looked at my records, and I believe I received my first copy of a draft still in a word processing version back in February. So it takes a while from completing a book to getting it really ready for release. And Meredith's had a bunch of people review it and read it. And of course, I learned when I was in the Navy, the more people you have reading something, the more work it is to compile everybody's comments and integrate and fix and correct. And oh man, it's a tough job. But Meredith, you're almost there. So when will the book be available to people who want to actually have a copy in their hot hands?
I'm very scared of saying a date, but basically it should be sometime between the 13th and the 20th of this month. Okay.
It's so just, before we go trick-or-treating, we should be able to have one.
Yes. Yes.
I give you a few extra days buffer there, but that's good. So I may give this as a gift to some people I know who need something this month. It's amazing how many friends I have in my neighborhood whose birthdays are in October.
Our daughter's birthday is in October, but I don't think I'm going to give her my book as a gift.
I attribute this to the fact that if you back up 9 months ago, that's in the dark ages, is what we call at the Naval Academy, the time of late January, early February. So that's why there's so many people whose birthdays are in October. That's my theory anyway.
Well, it's as good a theory as an axe.
All right. So you are want people to know more about the grid. Are you trying to frighten them?
Not really, though some people might think I am. I consider the grid to be fragile, and I consider that we are making decisions that make it more and more fragile. And to put it very simply, the decisions that are being made on the grid are leading to what I call a fatal trifecta. The fatal trifecta is we depend on renewables, but the renewables can go on and off. So we back up the renewables with natural gas, but natural gas can't be stored if there's any interruption in supply, or in the northern countries, if there's a cold winter, the power plants that use natural gas can't get the natural gas because houses for heating have priority on the pipelines. Okay, and then the third part of the fatal trifecta is that many people go like, "Oh, that's okay because we can get power from our neighbors." If you're in New England or Hydro-Québec, we'll get it from Hydro-Québec. If you're in California, we'll get it from Nevada. Well, the thing is, the neighbors have the same kind of weather that you're having, and we get approximately half the usual amount of energy or electricity from Hydro-Québec on a really cold day as we do on a mild day because they need it at home. And so I feel that when you begin this slide to dependence on your neighbors, dependence on renewables backed up by natural gas, which is constrained by the pipelines, and you can't store it, then rolling blackouts are likely to be on their way.
Well, some will say that you can store natural gas. After all, we have these large seasonal storage reservoirs. But where are they located?
Well, I'm not sure where they're located. Many of them are located in the south. But the issue really isn't, can you store it in a seasonal reservoir? The issue is, can you store it at the power plant? In other words, the power plant is dependent on what's delivered through the pipeline. It's pipeline constrained. We've got tons of shale gas, but New York isn't going to be able to use much of it because New York has made a law saying that no new pipelines can be built. And other states make these laws. We don't want to lock in fossil infrastructure, no new pipelines here. I mean, it's a noble thought, but if you're going to back up renewables in the existing grid, the way to back them up is with fast-acting natural gas plants.
Yeah, and many people forget this fact that the the speed with which you can deliver natural gas from one region to another depends on the pipeline between those two. And once you hit pipeline constraints, you just can't push any more gas through. I mean, you can elevate the pressure a little bit maybe and get a little bit more squeeze through, but the pipe's a pipe.
Yes. And
what so is- why don't we, other than the fact that there's opposition from a, you know, various opponents to building pipelines, what else prevents pipeline companies from simply pushing through and building enough pipelines to supply their customers at all hours of the day, all seasons of the year?
Oh man, basically to build a pipeline, you have to go through a whole bunch of jurisdictions. It's actually easier to build a power plant, even if nobody likes a power plant near them, because you know you get a certain level of permissions and you're done. But if with a pipeline, you're going through different areas, and it only takes one really solid no in one of those areas to stop the pipeline. So I think that's the trouble. The other thing is, this sounds a little odd, but it's true. The way a lot of the country is in RTO management of the grid, which means regional transmission organization. From a point of view of what does that actually mean? It means that there are all kinds of auctions. In other words, power plants bid in at auction, and then some of them are chosen and some are not, depending on how much they bid in. The cheaper ones are chosen. Then they discovered in most places that just doing this didn't provide them with enough reliable power. So then there's an auction for capacity. That is, the auction is, you are willing to bid in when we call you, and we're going to pay you to be standing ready. Then they realize, well, oh, actually, standing ready, just existing isn't standing ready. So we're going to pay you for really being ready. That's called an ancillary services auction. Then they discovered that really didn't work very well in New England. It wasn't working very well. So they said, we're going to have a winter reliability project. We're going to have special payments for power plants in the winter if they do certain things. And they end up, it's that every situation is another auction. Well, the power plants aren't really, you know, they're not managed by stupid people. And when you get right down to it, brinksmanship works. I mean, how can I put it? If there isn't enough supply, the price will go up and the power plant will make more money. The auction will have a higher clearing price. And so it's not that the power plants are doing this deliberately, but to some extent, when they get together in the knee pools and so forth, and they set up exactly what auctions are happening and what rules are happening, they are pushing to be sure that when they set the rules up, the rules are going to be really nice for their power kind of power plant, and that there will be situations of scarcity and situations of like, oh, we're almost at rolling blackouts, we've got to pay whatever it takes, and so forth. So, yeah, I don't know. It's kind of discouraging.
Yeah, it is discouraging to me that there have been people who have taught the world that you should never let a good crisis go to waste. Rahm Emanuel was famous for that. And far too many people that I talk to don't recognize the corollary to that is, well, if a crisis gives me the opportunity to do some things I want to do anyway, why don't I just initiate a crisis?
Well, Enron did.
Why don't I put ourselves in a situation where we have to respond in the way I want to respond anyway, and you know, go from there?
Well, that was the classic thing that happened when Enron. Everybody's like, "Oh, Enron did all this stuff to make California have rolling blackouts." And indeed, Enron was a very important player in why California had rolling blackouts in around 2001. But they didn't realize that Enron was actually pursuing a very reasonable business model, which is when there's scarcity, we get paid more. And I can take one of my power plants offline, and then guess what? I don't have to buy gas for that power plant, and the other power plants that I own will get paid more. And that worked. Unfortunately, it still works. And for example, ISO New England has set up something called pay per performance, which basically fines power plants if they don't show up when they're called on, when the grid is stressed. Well, that means, among other things, that ISO New England has to have a good definition of when the grid is stressed and so forth and so on in order to find the power plants only at those times, not when they're just not available because they're doing some maintenance. And it gets to be very, very complicated, but nobody in this is dumb, you understand? And they are trying to do the very best for their facility and their bottom line. And they aren't bad people. They're just trying to do the best for their bottom line because that's how the auctions are set up. You understand that before the RTOs and before all those auctions, it didn't really help a power plant to go offline, and it just didn't help it. I mean, reliability was actually valued by the system. Now it isn't valued by the system, but they keep trying to put yet another layer of auctions on it to value it. But the layers of auctions aren't working.
So is part of the problem that there's really no organization that is responsible for the complete delivery of you know, electricity to the customer from the generation all the way down to having it come out of your wall socket? There is no responsible organization for that.
Yes, that's true. That is true. And I have been at various meetings where someone said, well, you know, but there's no one responsible. And someone said, well, yes, that's true. But, you know, this is like a free market thing. And it's all going to work out because of the market is going to make it work out. And the thing is that works if the people can't game the market. Unfortunately, they can.
Well, who gets invited to the business meetings of the groups that set the rules, that establish these auctions, that you know, make this very confusing and rule-based system that's called deregulated make it work? Who gets invited? How does that happen?
Well, that is a very complicated question, but the basic idea is this: there's two groups that are allowed to propose rules to FERC, and FERC has to rule that FERC is the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and it has to rule, yes, we'll accept these rules or we won't accept these rules. Okay, so who are the two groups that can propose the rules? One is the ISO New England itself, or the grid operator. And the grid operator has a lot of people who do forecasts, scenarios, it has lawyers, and it proposes rules that it thinks will keep the grid going. Meanwhile, there's another group called the knee pool in the pools, I don't know what they're called besides the pools, but basically in that group, they can also propose rules, and they have usually a couple of sectors. Sectors mean different organizations that participate in the grid. So, for example, renewable energy would be one sector. Traditional energy would be another sector. Transmission operators would be a sector. There's even a sector for users, but there's only one sector for users. And so if all the users voted together, they would be in New England, they would be a full 1/6 of the votes. the other groups, all of whom have how can I put it? The other groups all have skin in the game, right? I mean, if you're a renewable energy operator, a traditional power operator, a public power thing like a rural electric cooperative, you're in a sector and you vote with that sector. And in general, I don't get to see the votes, you see, but I would think the sectors vote pretty closely together. In other words, if you're in the traditional generation sector, you probably vote along with everyone else in that sector. So, but you know, they split their votes under different circumstances. I'm just trying to say that these are the people who do the votes, and they put their proposal into FERC, and often the grid operator and the pool people from the participants committee all put their proposals in at the same time. They both put their proposals in at the same time, and that's called a jump ball filing. I have sections in my book about jump ball, and sometimes I feel, and one at the end of the sections about the jump ball filing, who proposed what, how FERC decided why. I mean, all I get this all out of not from participating in these, but rather FERC has to put all these filings and its rulings on its website, you know, so you can see it after the fact. I wrote about some of these jump ball filings, and at the end I said, I think I need to write another book that's just jump ball the novel, because I've left a lot of things out in my descriptions of those filings.
Yeah, reading the table of contents for your book, I would have to say that it could be classified as a bunch of mixed metaphors, with jump balls and Pollyannas and stress or not stress, and it's a fascinating set of different topics that come in. And again, going back to the fact that this is an important book, it's not a short book. It's got lots of very readable passages, and I have read it several times and enjoyed it thoroughly. And you all who are listening to Meredith can hear that she has a very accessible way of communicating. But there are 45 separate chapters in this book. It is a pretty incredible broad scope endeavor that we have here.
But Rod, you haven't told about the thing that I'm most proud of, the 10-page glossary.
Yes. There is a lengthy glossary. There's lots of endnotes. There's all kinds of citations in this book. It for people who really want to get a feel for how the grid works and how its rules are put together, you can't do better than doing this. Now, let's clear up some things. One who reads this book might get the impression that you have a negative perception of renewables.
Well, they,
didn't you grow up in the renewables business?
Yes, I did. I at one point in my life, I had my dream job, and my dream job was being in the renewable group at Electric Power Research Institute, running projects to improve renewables. I mean, I thought, well, this is it. This is my dream job. I'm set. I'm within the utility industry, but I'm working for Wright and you know, for the right way to make power. I'm proud of what I'm doing. And the trouble is that I began to realize how limited the renewables were, and how difficult it would be to run a whole grid on it. I mean, this was happening with me in like 1981, 1982. So, you know, when I see other people like, you know, Michael Schellenberger or Chris Kiefer that go like, well, you know, I began realizing we needed more than renewables. I'm like, yeah, Yeah, we do. And the trouble is, you know, I was living in Palo Alto. I was working at the Electric Power Research Institute, which is in Palo Alto. So I could go into any cocktail party, not that I went to cocktail parties, but any gathering in Palo Alto and say, well, I'm in the renewable group at EPRI. Oh, that's great. Let me get you a glass of wine. That's super. When I switched to the nuclear group, it was a little different because that was, you know, that was the bad people. And but I had come to the conclusion that they were the good people, but it was that they were doing, you know, non-polluting energy that would be really available all the time, that wasn't constrained by geography. For example, I was in the geothermal group. Well, geothermal energy is lovely. If you happen to be in an area where you have like some magma underground so you can make some steam or hot water. I mean, but a lot of the country, you know, is kind of flat and doesn't have magma. And if you are in an area that has magma, by the way, I hate to put it out, you're probably going to be around some very nice hills or mountains. And there's going to be someone saying, are you kidding? You're planning to drill in this meadow, this beautiful mountain meadow, and you're going to drill in it to make power? And you know they're right. I mean, you can put a nuclear plant any place you want. But you know, the renewables, you have to drill in that beautiful mountain meadow or put the wind turbine up on the hillside. Or anyway, so yes, I got very disillusioned. And people don't realize that most renewables just aren't available all the time and they need backup. And when you get to backup, what's backup? Well, if you happen to be around some dams, hydro can be a beautiful backup. For backup for renewables, you don't need something that can just load follow. Lots of things can load follow. Load tends to change kind of smoothly. But wind and solar, they tend to change kind of fast. And so you need something that can be fast reactive. And what we have for fast reactive right now is natural gas. People are saying, oh, it's going to be battery someday. Well, not at grid scale, I don't think. And I have a whole section in my book about investigating grid scale batteries. But it's going to be natural gas. Now, before I got my dream job, I had another job, which was I was working for a company that was trying to do something about the tremendous smogs that were in California in the 70s. And these smogs were basically caused mostly by the presence of nitrogen oxides. And nitrogen oxides came from different kinds of combustion processes, high temperature combustion processes, cars, diesels, gas-fired power plants. And so we were working all the time at trying to still keep the gas-fired power plant going, but not make the nitrogen oxides. And it's not easy because at a high temperature, the air burns itself. What I mean is the nitrogen in the air unites with the oxygen in the air to make nitrogen oxides. So it's not like getting rid of sulfur oxides where you can say, well, we'll use a low sulfur fuel. We'll clean up the fuel and we won't have sulfur going into the air. Well, you can't take the nitrogen and oxygen out of the air. If you're running at a high temperature, you're going to make nitrogen oxide. So you make all.
And if you want an efficient machine.
That's right.
I know Carnot. He says, run at the highest temperature you can, right?
Exactly. Lower temperatures mean less efficiency. So if you run it at a lower temperature, you're going to end up using more fuel to make the same amount of electricity. So it's a real bind that you're in. And I didn't see any way out of that bind. And so, well, I said, okay, I'm over at the, I've left that job now and I've got a job over in the renewable group at EPRI and this is great. And so I'm out of the bind. And then I thought, wait a minute, this group isn't going to replace all those gas turbines I was talking about before. It isn't going to do it. I mean, it isn't a matter of we're not willing, we don't have the energy, we don't have the willpower. It's a matter of we don't have the resource. And anyway, so that was difficult for me. But then it turned out that some geothermal power plants use very briny liquid to make the power because that's what's underground. So in some places. So I was doing a fair amount of stuff about corrosion control for briny liquids in geothermal power plants. And it turned out that I was doing a project which was very similar to a project that was being done in the pressurized water reactor group about corrosion control in crevices in pressurized water reactors. So I began meeting with them and we were comparing results, talking about joint projects and stuff. And then they had an opening, so they offered me a job. And I thought, you know, I think these people really are doing something worthwhile, but oh my gosh, how am I going to explain I'm moving from the renewable group to the nuclear group? Anyway, so yeah. So I didn't get up in the morning and think, oh, you know, renewables are some kind of funny dream or whatever. I mean, it came painfully. It came painfully. I didn't have a Road to Damascus conversion experience. I wasn't famous as a renewable advocate when I changed. I mean, it was kind of a little lonely change with me and trying to explain it to my friends. I don't know. It's not an easy change, Rod.
Yeah, I know. Well, of course, I shouldn't say that. I really don't know because I'm one of those people that have been a nuclear guy essentially my whole life. And as I've mentioned to somebody else the other day who was, I guess his name is Ravi, which means sun in some language. And Ravi said, I guess I've always been a solar guy. And I said, well, my name sounds like Adams, so I've always been an Adams guy.
Yeah, that's one way to look at it. Well, one thing I will say that was pro-nuclear in my background, though by the time I was an adult and at EPRI and everything, it didn't matter very much, is that I'm Jewish, and my family just thought, you know, Rickover was such a important figure for Jewish people innovating, for Jewish people having a strong role in the military. And, you know, so, I mean, we were kind of, without being particularly one way or another about it in public, I think we were all Rickover fans. So when I did move to PWR, I could at least look back and say, well, if my mother was still alive, she wouldn't make fun of me.
Well, it's always important to have your mother on your side.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, my mom's been one of my bigger fans over the years, so I always appreciate that. Now, I remember reading you writing about the Winter Reliability Program way back, it was 2015, 2016, yes. Something like that. And that Winter Reliability Program worked in the sense that it was put in place just before a very brutal winter, and that oil stored on site kicked in, and of course gas turbines, you know, that normally burn natural gas, if they're modified and they can burn oil, they can be just as responsive on oil as they are on gas. But of course, oil is kind of a fragile fuel for us, at least it always has been. So didn't the FERC decide, though, that winter reliability program was somehow wrong, even though it worked?
Oh, yeah. They said, you cannot do this anymore. The reason is, and I have this whole little section in the book called They Named the Fuel, you know, that old thing called Name That Tune. Well, uh-huh. What the one thing that an ISO or a FERC isn't allowed to do is name the fuel. In other words, if they do something which is preferential to one fuel over another, then they're being bad people. So basically, FERC said to ISO New England, Very nice that you've run this winter reliability project. So pleased that it worked. You have to stop it now. What you have to do is you have to set up some kind of auction in which the people will bid in whatever fuel they have, and they will bid in, and you will pay them to be available in the winter to make themselves reliable. It'll be worth their while to make themselves reliable, and they'll enter the auction. And the paper performance, it doesn't work as well as it might. So the reason I say that, you say, oh, Meredith, you're just being cynical. But one time in the summer, paper performance was triggered. What happened? The day was hotter and more humid than ISO had predicted, and a big power plant, a gas-fired one, went offline, and the grid was in some kind of trouble. And all of a sudden, you know, people, energy was flowing in from the neighbors, and the balancing authority was working hard, and it kept it going. It was great. There wasn't even a flicker of light. But meanwhile, at the end of this experience, paper performance was supposed to settle up payments between the power plants that didn't go online when they were called to on and the grid was clearly stressed, and the power plants that did go online. So the power plants that didn't go online were supposed to pay part of their revenues to the power plants that did go online. And that was the whole way that paper performance was going to work. You will have to keep stuff online, available to go online when the grid is stressed, because otherwise you're going to end up paying money to the people who did keep stuff available. Well, that experience lasted about 8 hours that the grid was stressed. And the paper performance formula paid $8 million out to the power plants that went online more than it collected from the power plants that didn't go online. So, you know, this is not make you feel comfortable about the future, because in the future, you see, how do I put it?
Where did that $8 million come from?
Oh, well, they assessed all the power plants, the ones that went online, the ones that didn't go online. And even, this was kind of funny, they had, they pay a capacity payment to energy efficiency groups saying, well, you know, because you're using efficient, making people more efficient, you're sort of available to us. But the energy efficiency groups weren't available for this paper performance fund transfer at that time. But because they got capacity payments, they got dinged to contribute to the $8 million. I mean, it was just, this isn't the kind of thing that makes you comfortable that it's all going to work. You see, it all worked then because it was in the summer and there was plenty of natural gas, okay? But in the winter, when there's not natural gas, you can't make a ruling that makes natural gas or oil appear. I mean, it does. You got to pay. Anyway, so.
As I recall, even though we, you know, you and I agree that the winter reliability program worked at the time that it needed to work, it got really tight towards the end of that, right? Some of the storage tanks start running dry, and there was ice in the rivers, and they couldn't deliver oil.
Things
were a little bit hairy.
Things were hairy. They had to raise bridges during the middle of the rush hour in order to let oil tankers through. They had icebreakers involved. The plants had one day more oil available. They had started out with like 9 days worth of oil. Oh, yeah. It was getting hairy. But you see the thing.
So there's another novel for you, the winter reliability program that didn't work.
Well,
that sounds really exciting. You could write really good stuff about that.
Oh, I could. I could indeed. I mean, and it would be a sprawling novel of icebreakers and oil men and
heroic tanker drivers that fought their way through the ice and snow to make it to the plant just as it was about to go on its last burp of oil.
Well, you know, I have to say, though, that as someone who lives in the Northeast, I don't joke about those guys who drive the oil trucks. They are heroes, really. They go out in all kinds of weather. They have a load behind them that can cause a huge fire, and they don't cause huge fires, and they get through. They are so trained and so professional, and I think most of us don't appreciate that. I mean, somebody says, "Oh, you know, I've got a license to drive hazardous, and I drive oil in the winter. You know, I deliver oil in the winter." We don't realize. You know, we should just say thank you, thank you, thank you.
Well, that's why they need to be made the hero of a novel.
Yeah, you know, you're right.
but again, one of the things that you're trying to point out is that the grid really shouldn't be fragile and shouldn't be this really tantalizing source for dramatic fictionalization. We should be able to depend on it and think of it as something that just is going to be there, but there has to be somebody who's making it always there. So do you suggest that perhaps we went the wrong direction when we broke up the monopolies?
Well, I think so. I think so. I think the thing is that we have some proof of that right now. We can have financial proof. The idea was that the monopolies were very subject to regulatory capture, and the prices would rise and so forth. And indeed, you know, if you have a regulator in a state, and then you have a couple of big utilities in that state, the regulators may all be thinking, when I retire, I'm going to have a really nice job at that utility. But as a matter of fact, the areas that weren't turned into the auctions, and where the buck actually stops with the utility PUC interactions, have lower prices, and you never hear about them. What I'm trying to say is, if you hear such and such area is about to run out of electricity this winter, or, oh, there are problems there this summer, it's going to be an RTO area. I mean, you just watch for that and you'll see. So, yeah. I think it should go back to that. And the other thing is, and this was very satisfying to me, I wrote in there that if you begin looking at the layers of auctions and the RTOs, it takes a very thick book to explain it. I have written the book. But at any rate, it's very hard to explain what's going on. I mean, for example, CASPER is a special auction for subsidized resources in the capacity markets. And what the heck does that mean? I mean, it takes a bunch of the book to explain what that means. So people can't follow what's going on. Well, in the regulated areas, they have the PUC has to propound a integrated resource plan for the area, what the load is going to be and how it's going to be met. And back when I was involved in that sort of thing, the PUCs wanted varied power plants. They wanted not the most expensive power plants, but they wanted varied power plants because they felt, well, you know, there might be some new rule with the coal plants, and then some of them will go offline, and then there might be some new rule with the gas plants, and they won't be able to get gas during some times. So they wanted varied so that there was a minimum level of risk. And it turns out that they have the minimum level of risk, and they have lower prices. So I'm like, exactly why do we have these RTO areas? And then anyway, one of the things I said is an intelligent layman can read an integrated resource plan for an area and understand what it says. I mean, it took me years before I could understand MOPR, CASPER, and what the big deal was about in terms of capacity auctions of various sorts.
Well, in just about the time you figure it out, it will change, right?
Yes, exactly. Well, an integrated resource plan, they have to have a reason to change it. It can't just be another ruling about something or another vote in the participants committee. It has to be integrated resource plans are clear and they change for reasons.
and they change slowly, usually.
Well, you know,
there's some sort of planning cycle that does have some responsiveness to it, but it doesn't. It's not something you have to keep reading on a daily or weekly or monthly basis.
Oh yeah, you can understand what's going on with the plan in your area, and to understand what's going on with the rules in your area, I subscribe to, I read constantly. I subscribe to RTO Insider, which is a trade magazine, which is as expensive as you'd expect such a magazine to be. I mean, it's only online. They couldn't possibly do a print version because things are changing so fast all the time. It's just an online version. And absolutely. It's not a planning cycle, really. I mean, there's a planning cycle at ISO New England. They try and plan, but you see, the thing is that they put together their reliability project, and it gets accepted, and then it's like, but you don't understand. You named oil, and that's not going to fly around here.
I personally had a problem with the winter reliability program when I found out that there was a payment made to these specific dual capability power plants because they were storing fuel on site. Yet there was no payment made to plants like Vermont Yankee or even the I can't remember the name of the coal plant. There was several large generators that had exactly the same amount of fuel on board. Matter of fact, more available fuel stored on site, but they received no payments at all.
Oh, I remember that very well. And I remember that when, you know, I was fighting for the survival of Vermont Yankee, I was pro-nuclear advocacy was what I was doing. And this grid stuff was sort of like, whatever. Yeah, I got to learn something about it sometime. Yeah, that was very upsetting because, you know, they paid, what, I don't know, $30 million for winter reliability oil. And, you know, the people at Vermont Yankee and Pilgrim were like, could you show a little love around here? I mean, we're always here for you guys.
And right. And those plants supposedly closed down because they were uneconomical. And I'm using my big air quotes here. Yeah. But uneconomical is defined within certain market parameters.
Uneconomical is defined within parameters that are basically set up by rules made by a group where both end users and nuclear plants are a very small portion of the group's votes. And that's basically the fact.
I'm sure it's a little more complicated than this, but I believe I read somewhere, and maybe it was in your book, that when you've got, say, there's 20 gas-fired power plants and one nuclear plant, the nuclear plant gets one out of 21 votes in the sector that it's in.
Yeah, and pretty much.
The gas plants get 20 votes, even though they may roughly have the same contribution to overall electricity. Maybe the gas plants got a lot more capacity, but nuclear plants just go to their power output and stay there.
Well, yeah, basically there are pages and pages, which I can't even begin to follow, on how votes are allowed at the participants meeting. But basically, yes, the gas plants are in the same sector with the nuclear plants, and the gas plants dominate that sector. Yeah. And so they vote at the same time. Plus, there's a supplier sector, and I suspect that although gas companies can't vote, but they are allowed to be in the meetings. You understand? You and I can't go to the meetings, mm-hmm. but gas companies can go to the meetings. There's all this stuff. For example, in some cases, a group can vote. There can be a group of suppliers that add up to one vote. I mean, this stuff is incredibly arcane. It makes the business of the local utility duking it out with the local PUC in some open meetings and some closed meetings look absolutely simple and transparent.
And influenceable by, I mean, although PUCs generally aren't elected positions, although they are in some jurisdictions, they're still appointed by elected officials.
They're appointed by elected officials. And if the utility, if the power is unreliable or the power shoots up to double the price or whatever, that elected official is going to get on the radio and explain that this is not what he intended. He is going to have to make some changes. Heads are going to roll. And, you know, but you know, there's no equivalent of in the RTO areas. There just isn't an equivalent to that.
Well, Meredith, we've been talking for approaching an hour now. Are there any things about your book that you would like to make sure that the listeners hear? Besides, go buy the book. It's available on Amazon, or at least it will be by the time you all hear this, because I'm going to release it in a few days.
I don't know. I'm going to say one thing about the book, and that is that I have been told by people who've read it that this information is really not easily available other places. If you want to know some of these things about how the RTOs operate, how the grid operates, what the participants committees are, what these auctions are really doing, it's not easy information to find. And if you do find it, it's going to be in a fairly diffuse form. Okay, you might go to the ISO New England website and decide that you're going to catch up with all their newsletters, or you're going to, you know, subscribe to RTO Insider at great expense and try and figure out, you know, let's see, try and follow that, which you really, it's a wonderful magazine. But if you don't know the basics, you're not going to follow the articles. And, you know, so I wanted people to know that when someone says, well, nuclear can't compete, it can't compete in auctions where kilowatt hours are not the best way to make money. The best way is to do the capacity payments. And people go like, what? And I'm saying, no, that's right. That's right. That they can't compete as the way the auctions are set up. So I just want people to know that even though it's a dense book. A lot of people will probably go like, you know, what were you thinking? I try to make the writing readable and clear, and I hope I've succeeded fairly well at that. The problem is the subject matter, but the problem is if you decide, well, I'll get the subject matter some other way, it's going to be hard.
Yeah, I think one could probably buy a whole box full of your books for the price of an RTO Insider subscription.
That's right. It's over $1,000 a year.
Yeah. So you know, this is one way to get a really good deal if you want to get a basic understanding, is to read. Of course, you can also read your book in a much shorter period of time than one could catch up on all the RTO Insider back issues to get to where you have the kind of knowledge that you share. So I like your book. I think people should buy it. It is an important topic that too many people who are interested in energy and electricity, for one reason or another, simply just don't have an understanding of. They just don't know, in some cases, how fragile the grid really is and how close we have already come to stressing that grid. And we still have more plants due to be shut down, because they are not economical within the rules that the grid participants have created. And as you noted, there's nobody who really has the motive to make any changes, because as the grid fragility becomes exposed, that crises will occur, prices will scream up, somebody will collect a lot more money than they expected to, because of the scarcity and because of making something that is an important underlying commodity for our economy. They're turning it into something very precious at certain times.
Yes.
And that's a scary thought.
Yeah.
So, again, Meredith, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on the show, Rod. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Take care.
Thank you. Bye.
There's a way, such a better way today. Today, raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today, now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better